Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Our guest today is Alex Beard. Alex is a former English teacher at a London comprehensive and is now a senior director at Teach for All, a growing network of independent organisations working to ensure that all children fulfil their potential. He's fortunate to spend his time travelling the world in search of the practices that will shape the future of learning and has written about his experience for The Independent, Guardian, Financial Times and Wired. His book, Natural Born Learners, is a user's guide to transforming learning in the 21st century. And this will be the topic of our discussion today. Hello, Alex. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, Barry. It's great to be here.
Okay, well, could we start by you telling us perhaps a bit about your background and what it was that prompted you to write the book?
Certainly. So I was a teacher in a secondary school in London. I started doing that about 10 years ago. And I had gone to a nice primary school myself and a lovely secondary school in the countryside where everything was pretty easy and teaching really just consisted of standing at the front of the classroom and talking about ideas. And I thought that that's what teaching was going to be like when I started doing it myself. But it turned out it really wasn't. And the kids that I taught faced real challenges. About half of them were on free school meals, more than half spoke English as a second language, and they all came to school really far behind where they should have been, looking at sort of average progress that kids make over time in education. And yet, despite all of that, I felt really sort of unsupported and unprofessional as a teacher. And slowly we sort of struggled along, and over a couple of years in the classroom, we managed to, by hook or crook, get them their C grades at GCSE. And it was all a lot of blood, sweat and tears and no real science. And I got to the end of that experience about 7 years ago, just feeling that although it had seemed like we had some success, I was frustrated that I hadn't been a great professional in the classroom, that the kids themselves were smart and witty and capable of a lot. And we'd only really focused on these narrow set of exam criteria and techniques. And it sort of felt really old-fashioned. Yeah. And then around me, I was noticing the world changing a lot, and we were making these advances in neuroscience and psychology, inventing these new pieces of technology. And I just wondered that, you know, if we used all of those new inventions, used all of that latest insight into how our minds worked, couldn't we maybe reinvent and reimagine school for today? And create a new type of profession where kids were able to develop all of their faculties fully, where no kids fell behind, where we were preparing kids, yes, for the jobs of tomorrow, but at the same time also preparing them to be happy, well-rounded, active citizens within society. And so I then joined this organization called Teach for All, and we work on various education projects all over the world in 50 different countries. And there I began to encounter people who are doing things differently. So people running great schools, policymakers thinking differently about how to set up education systems, teachers doing amazing work in classrooms. And I just thought, where is the book? Where is the place that I can go to read about all of this? So that it's both talking about what an education in the future should look like, but it's also recognizing all that science and all those inventions to show how we could improve education for all kids. And so that's what set me off on this journey to explore the best practices around the world and to write about what education could be in the 21st century.
Okay, brilliant. Well, you went all over the world pretty much. Could you just give us an overview of that experience?
Yeah, so I guess I had two questions in mind when I set out. The first one was this idea about technology. So if all of the jobs that kids in my class were planning on doing in the future were likely to be automated, what instead should our children be learning today? And then the second question was, and how did we ensure that was happening at a high level of quality for all children. And so when I was thinking about where to go, I wanted to look for examples where schools were doing new things and interesting things, and they were succeeding not only for the wealthier and more advantaged kids, but for all children within their society. So there was sort of a certain section of schools that were serving more marginalised communities within different countries that I really wanted to focus in on. And so the first thing I used, I guess, was the PISA International assessments to give me a sense of which school systems in the world were doing best overall. And so those are the tests which were administered every 3 years by this think tank called the OECD. They're given to 15-year-old kids in about 100 countries around the world, and they test them on their maths and science and their reading and writing, as well as on things now like teamwork, cooperation, problem solving, and so on. And at the top of those lists are the East Asian sort of education superpowers like South Korea, like China, Singapore, and then also some Scandinavian countries like Finland or Estonia. So I made those places ones that I was definitely going to visit. And then I think in other countries around the world, like the US or the UK or India, because they have very unequal education systems, you get these examples of really great practice, of great teaching or great work with early child development, or great examples of schools doing new and interesting things. And so I sort of picked the places I wanted to go to based on all of that initial research.
Okay. And how did you come up with the name of the book?
Yeah. So I had originally set out with this idea that I was going to find some fantastic invention or piece of technology that was bound to revolutionize the way that we learned. And I first of all went to Silicon Valley and went to this place called Singularity University. And those are the guys, it was founded by this guy called Ray Kurzweil. And he is the author of something called The Singularity Is Near. And he's the one that predicted that we would be able to overcome the limitations of our human bodies within the next 20 or 30 years and upload our consciousness to the internet, basically. And so I thought that the book was going to be all about technology and how it was going to revolutionize learning, how artificial intelligence was going to augment our own human intelligence. But as I went around, I guess I began to find that all of that was quite overblown. I went in Singularity University to their place they call the classroom, and I expected it to be filled with these amazing gadgets. And actually, it was just some very basic VR experiences, a couple of out-of-the-box so-called robot teachers who I just didn't think would be very good at anything. And what I found as I went along was that actually we have been massively underestimating the power of our own human minds in all of this talk of how education should be for the economy, and we have to think about jobs, and we need to use computers, and we're going to be able to automate everything. And our education systems are sort of defined, I think, by this paradigm. You have this sort of centralized command and control model where you set targets, you have your inputs and your outputs, and you create this perfect data system in which kids are almost reduced a bit to ciphers. Yeah. And so what I wanted to do was to make an argument that we've got all of that wrong and we need new metaphors to think about human learning. And so Natural Born Learners was the title, because I want us to reappraise quite how powerful our human minds are, to understand that our brains aren't like computers, they don't learn like them, but they are instead alive, unruly, engaged in this continual process of inquiry. They're capable of huge things, of emotion, of learning, yes, of empathy, of happiness. And I just thought that all of these things needed to be in our vision of the education of the future. And on top of that, I think we've got this idea that an education system is a technical thing that's all to do with a system of management. But in fact, I want us to understand that human learning is communal, it's social. We learn best from other human beings rather than from books or from computers. And it's just this idea that the system isn't something that's out there that's being run by policymakers, but that we are the system.
Yeah.
We make up those day-to-day decisions about what happens in classrooms. We learn from one another, and it's all very human. And yet I also think that we can do so much more to maximize that capacity. If we treat kids like robots in classrooms, then they'll learn a robotic and narrow set of skills. But if we see children and adults in the full breadth of their faculties, I think we'd create a different type of education system. One that's nonetheless high performing and excellent and aspires to real professionalism, but at the same time, one that doesn't reduce and narrow our powers, but develops them in their full expression.
Okay, well, that's great. And I suppose you took that understanding and that wider perspective of who we are as learners and what we're capable of, and you divided the book basically into three sort of tenets. Could you tell us about that and what was the decision behind that?
Yeah, that's right. And so the three tenets of the book are thinking anew, doing better, and taking care. And those three tenets for me form the three pillars of what I think the education of the future should focus on. So thinking anew, first of all, is all about understanding what the true potential of our human minds is. And it argues that we have internalized this metaphor as the mind being like a machine or a computer, which leads you to think that learning is a question of inputs and outputs. But although, yes, our minds do work in like that in some ways. So, for example, memorization is actually a really important thing for kids to do. There's some rote learning is important to master the basics of how maths works or how language works. But actually, if you stop there, then you limit human learning. And the thing that really brought this home to me was a couple of things, I guess. The first one was looking at early child development. And there are a number of people there who have shown that from the moment that we're born, we are these incredible inquiring beings. There's a psychologist called Alison Gopnik who calls us the scientists in the crib.
I've interviewed her, actually.
Oh, have you? Yeah, she's great. And I just think that, and we're reaching out into the world and learning about it in ways that are so vast, you know, both using all of our senses, our sight, our hearing, our touch, our taste, and continually getting feedback from the world on how things work. And it was that, then the work that people have done on the nature of our intelligence, whether you look at Carol Dweck and growth mindset, you look at the work of Eric Kandel and his studies of sea slugs, which show the neural plasticity that we all enjoy, that basically our brains are completely plastic and capable of learning throughout our lives. They're continually remaking themselves. And the process is not mechanistic, but organic. And so this first part about thinking anew is to say, look, we are capable of learning a whole lot more than we're currently doing. And we'll do that learning better if we can embrace this more organic understanding of our minds rather than this mechanistic approach. And there I visited some schools where kids literally learn in 1 year, 2 years worth of stuff that they might learn in other schools. So there was one in London called King Solomon Academy that I visited, and it's been in the past couple of years number one on of all schools in the UK on the Progress 8 score, which means it's kids from age 11 to 16 learn more than they do in any other school in the country. And I think that's fundamentally because they believe deeply in the plasticity of the minds of their kids, and because they've then developed ways of teaching them which help them to learn an awful lot. So thinking anew was all about that, thinking anew about how our minds work, what our cognitive powers really are. The second part around doing better. This was just the idea that our education systems, I think, have become so narrowly focused on, well, first it used to be the five GCSEs, including English and maths. And what I'd seen in my own classroom was that was narrowing down the focus of what an education was to a narrow core set of knowledge and skills. And I think when you think about what the future is going to hold for children, whether they are preparing for a future in which they're going to be in competition with machines for the few remaining jobs, or in which they're going to have to create their own work, or in which they're going to need to find their own pursuits because all work has been outsourced to robots, then this idea of human creativity becomes incredibly important. Creativity is one of the things that distinguishes us from what machines are able to do. And it's also the arena in which we're able to find our own self-expression. And so I just think doing better means embracing this idea of creativity and craft in education, helping kids not just to know things, but also to be able to do things in the world, whether that's finding the job that they really love doing or a particular pursuit that they're really interested in. And that also ties to this idea that, you know, to engage in this process of lifelong learning, you need to find the thing that's your passion, the thing that you want to do all of the time. And I think too often we sort of crush that out of kids in schools, or we don't give them the opportunity to find the things they're going to be interested in. And that section finishes with this idea that the ultimate craft, the ultimate creative act that we can engage in as human beings is the act of teaching. So I think that teaching is the number one most important profession of the future. If you look at those papers that have been put out there which say that everything's going to be automated, the jobs least likely to be automated are all of the more human professions. So teaching features very highly, therapists and other types of roles where people are working with other humans and trying to get the most out of them. And I think that if you imagine the role of teaching as being someone who creatively applies their understanding of the science of learning, their understanding of the motivators of human behavior, their understanding and knowledge of a particular subject area, an ability to use the latest technologies in creative ways, then I think we could create this idea of the teacher as the ultimate job of the 21st century. And I do think it needs a bit of rebranding. And then the final part of the book, Taking Care, I mean, that just tries to recognize that the ultimate purpose of education, in my eyes, is not simply to prepare kids for the world of work, but to build healthier, happier societies. And so there, it looks at topics like well-being. How do you prepare kids to feel happy and have good mental health in the world today? And I went to some different schools in the US where they're doing different things with that. KIPP schools, where they're focusing a lot on character development and trying to build the resilience of children. And also then to this amazing school called Breakthrough Magna in Hartford, Connecticut, where they are teaching kids mindfulness on a daily and weekly basis to give them the tools that they need to be able to manage their own emotions throughout their lives. And it was just fantastic. But then even more than that, to create these healthy societies, then I think what we need to embrace is this idea of what it takes to build strong societies. And so in that, I think, you know, it might sound corny to talk about it, but it's, for me, it's all about democracy. What does it take to build strong, thriving democracies? And now it comes down, I think, to critical thinking, the ability to analyze the world around you and form your own independent opinions about it based on the evidence that's in front of you. But also this idea of cooperation, or maybe even solidarity. Like, how can our schools actually build these things in the classrooms and be engines of social cohesion and inclusion over time? So those are the three tenets, I think, of the education of the future.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, for me, I found the book absolutely fascinating, Alex, especially as an ex-teacher myself, and the journey you went on. And as you say, you started off in Silicon Valley, you went to Finland, you went to Southeast Asia. That side of the book was really interesting. But also, what I thought was great at the end was how you brought it all together and you, from what you'd learnt, and basically created a manifesto of good practice. I know you've covered some of these things already, but it'd be nice just to go through them briefly. So the first point you make is learn forever.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that, as I mentioned before, we are natural born learners. We all enter the world with this incredible capacity for inquiry, this desire to uncover and find things out. And what our schools aren't doing very well at the moment is to continue to fuel that inbuilt ability that we have, an inbuilt desire we have for learning. And so I think in the future, this idea of lifelong learning is going to become ever more important. And I think in two ways. So first of all, if we're preparing for a world in which the future is uncertain, we're not sure what kinds of professions people will have or what kinds of roles they'll have within society, then it's really important for people to be able to retrain throughout their lives, pick up new skills, adapt to new challenges. And at the same time, I just think that to learn is the ultimate end of human existence in itself. I think that we exist to learn, to master new skills, to pursue our passions, to better develop an ability to express ourselves, to explore who we are and what our role in the world is. So I just think lifelong learning is so important. If you find that thing that is your outlet, then you're likely to be happier, to feel better. So learning forever, for me, encompasses all of those things. It's basically maintaining that passion that we have, that desire we have to learn from the earliest stage.
And then the second one is, and again, you've touched on this, is think critically. Now, in the Middle Way Society, we talk about provisionality, which is basically the practice of holding your beliefs lightly and being open to alternatives. Mm. So is that something you think we can cultivate? Some people are naturally disposed that way, but you obviously think we can learn that.
Yeah, I do. One of the places that I end up at in the book is with this idea of doubt. I think that there's far too much certainty in the world, and our education systems also deal quite a lot in certainty. There are right and there are wrong answers. You know, an exam has a mark scheme and you're aspiring to give the right answer there. Whereas in the world, there aren't rights and wrongs. So I think that currently our schools aren't doing a great job of setting kids up for that world, but I believe that they can. And two examples spring to mind. So one, I spent some time in a school in Newham in East London with Philosophy for Children. And Philosophy for Children is a brilliant program that's been around for many years, that originated in the US. And there I just saw a classroom of six-year-olds, and there were six-year-olds. Newham is the most diverse borough with more languages spoken in it than any other place in the UK. And there was a class of year two children who were being asked to reflect on a scenario in which the world had been divided into Usians and Lemians, and they were all Usians. And Usia had suffered some kind of disaster, and so all the Usians had to go to Lemia to live. And then the teacher just asked them a lot of questions about what it then meant for their identity to be living in this new country of Lemia, how they might feel, what might happen. And the kids were talking about it, and they had different opinions. Some of them voiced opinions that were troubling. Some of them voiced opinions that you might have wanted to hear. But the important thing that happened there was not that they were then told that these were right or wrong opinions that they had, but they were allowed as a group to talk to one another about what they thought. And I think that sort of space for debate, in which nobody intervenes to police the discussion, is so crucial in our world today, in which every debate that somebody takes part in is typically very polarized, in which people tend to find others whose opinions match theirs.
Yeah.
And it feels to me like schools are the only places left where we can preserve and easily have access to these kinds of open public discussions. And so schools need to have more of those. And I think teachers need to recognize that they don't have to have the answers in those kinds of scenarios. Yeah. And in fact, if you say that you do have the answers, you can actually be undermining kids' thinking.
You mentioned mindfulness earlier on, and I'm just made me think of some research by a psychologist in the States called Dan Kahan. And he has done research on blinkered thinking. And he says that education and intelligence are actually no safeguard against blinkered thinking.
Mm.
So critical thinking be provided with tools to argue your way out of cognitive dissonance more effectively.
Yeah.
What seems to be critical in making better decisions is an openness to being wrong and curiosity.
Mm.
And often with something like mindfulness, you know, you can sit there with your thoughts and not get emotionally hijacked by them to the same extent, or put them in a wider perspective. So they both seem very important, critical thinking, but also mindfulness or other embodied practices are important too in making better decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. So I think that with the idea that your level of intelligence or your ability to think critically is not a guard against extremism has been well proven. I interviewed Maggie Nawaz, who runs Quilliam, the counter-extremism think tank, and he said exactly that. In fact, it's the people, it's often people who are quite well educated who are most vulnerable to becoming extremist, because those people that are cultivating them are good at showing how there are certain connections between events in history or within the world, which then add up to a theory, a conspiracy theory, or a theory of how the world is.
Yes.
And so I think that certainly mindfulness and other embodied practices, I think, are a good way to get to that. We talk a lot in education about metacognition.
Yeah.
You know, being aware of the thoughts that you're having, understanding where your learning has come from, or how you best learn, or what situations you most thrive in. And I've always felt this idea, this kind of metacognitive ability, is the highest end of education, to be able to look dispassionately at your thoughts and ideas, and to have enough knowledge to do so in a fully informed way.
Okay, so the next one is number three is get creative.
Yeah, so get creative. Again, this comes back to the idea that, well, creativity is both the human characteristic that's least likely to be automated by machines in the future, but I think more importantly that creativity is our route to self-expression, purpose, happiness and well-being. There's some great stuff from Richard Sennett in The Craftsman about how mastery of a craft is the ultimate human act in which we find meaning and purpose in our lives, and I think that that's the thing that I'm most interested by. I went into this one classroom in California in a school called High Tech High. And High Tech High does everything around projects. So kids spend about half their time each year in these big cross-curricular projects with these, you know, bold and exciting names. In this one classroom, I saw it was a single class of kids. One group of them were developing these biodegradable seed pods. They were sort of the biology science people. There was another group of people who were scripting and preparing to film a documentary, and they were sort of the English humanities kids. And then there was another group who were building drones completely from scratch, and they were the more tech-focused kids. And all of them were then going to do this project together where they'd go for a week's camping in the wilderness. They were going to do an aerial survey of the degradation of plant life in this national park, and then drop seed pods where they were needed to replenish the things. And I just thought, this is the fullest expression of creativity. Everybody is using these multifaceted skills in a collective endeavor and finding their own purpose and meaning within the project.
It obviously was a lot of fun as well for the kids. Why is play so important? To what degree are we enabling kids to play in classrooms around the world?
Yeah, I think play is incredibly important in a child's learning. Play is the activity in which young kids begin to understand how the world works. There's this amazing early childhood centre in Corby, near Kettering, where they work with kids from almost birth up to the moment they start school. And whereas we see a lot now about a lot of talk about school readiness, preparing kids to be able to read and so on, actually the science shows that allowing kids to play is the most effective thing that you can do to help them develop as learners. So they have this thing there called schemas, and kids, they notice that kids, without being coached or told or taught, develop these kinds of play schemas. They might have engineering schema where they're sort of like digging and trying to understand things, an enveloping schema where they're taking on different identities, counting schemas where they line things up. And in all of those, you can actually see the shoots of different subjects emerging. Like you can almost see where maths has emerged from in the human mind, or where science has come from, or engineering, or where writing has come from. That the kids begin to do these things, scratching marks on things. And it's almost like you can, if you see it through that lens, you can always see the emergence of the sort of modern human mind in these small children. And to give another example, in Finland is still number one in the world in making the most of its human capital. So it develops its people better than any other country. It's also number one in the world in terms of happiness, according to the UN's recent report this year. And there, the kids' school experience, both in kindergarten before they begin school and during elementary school, is so focused on giving them space and time to play. In playing, so first of all, they don't start school until they're 7 years old. That's when formal education begins. And then in classrooms in primary school, they have as much time in craft activities and in arts activities as they do in maths or in English. And play is where, as a child, you learn to set your own objectives and then pursue them. You have a sense of being able to give yourself goals and then to deeply engage yourself in activities. It's also where you can learn to take risks and to fail in a non-threatening, like non-high-stakes environment. So you can learn about the extent of your abilities. You can learn what you are able to do and what you aren't able to do. You can get better at doing things in an environment which is very low stakes because you're just playing.
Yeah.
So it's so fundamental, I think.
Yeah.
It's so fundamental to human learning.
That segues really well into another of your points, that we start early. Could you tell us something about the Heckman curve, and why does that turn all we believe about learning on its head?
Yeah, that's right. So as a teacher in a secondary school, I'd always seen a hierarchy of teachers. The most important ones were university lecturers. The next most important teachers were secondary school English teachers like me, so I felt quite good about what I was doing. Then we all looked down on the primary school teachers, who we sort of thought of as being like, you know, slightly better qualified mums or grannies. And then there were nursery professionals who we just, you know, saw as whatever, young kids straight out of school who were just looking to make a few quid. And so our hierarchy of thinking about what's important in education is completely set on the complexity of the knowledge that you're trying to impart at any one time. That is completely the wrong way around. So this economist called James Heckman, he's a Nobel Prize winner, and he's done lots of research in the field of education, has studied a number of different education interventions and created a graph. And on the graph is probably something called the Heckman curve. And so on the x-axis, you've got the life of a child from 0 to 18 and beyond. And on the other axis, you've got the return you get on investing in that child's education. And the absolute highest return you get on your investment is investing in a child's education at the very beginning of their life.
Nice. Yeah.
And then the curve quite scarily drops very quickly from the first 3 years through age 3 to 5 into primary school, into secondary school, and off into adult life.
Yeah.
So the older a child gets, the more money, time, expertise society has to invest in supporting that child in order to get good outcomes, better learning, in order to change that child's life chances. And yet we still continue today to make our investment in the wrong place.
Sure. But I suppose it's crucial also to tailor that learning appropriately, because then you also point out that how harmful it can be to force kids, for example, to read at 4 and 5, because you can quite easily put them off.
Yeah, that's right. So again, so there's some interesting studies on this. The example of Finland, I think, is most instructive. Kids there do not learn to read until they're at least 7 years old. And then yet by the age of 15, Finnish kids are amongst the strongest readers in the whole world. Whereas in the UK, we're trying to get kids to begin reading at an earlier age, as young as four. And our kids are much worse readers on average than the kids in Finland. And there have been studies that have been that show that the earlier you start learning to read, say comparing between learning to read at the age of four and learning to read at the age of six or seven, by the time you get to age 15, if you've started at four or at age seven, it makes no difference to the quality of your reading. But what it does make a difference to is your enjoyment of reading.
Yeah.
And actually, the kids that start later enjoy reading more than the kids that start earlier.
Yeah.
So we have to understand how kids' brains develop and that there's an order of operations. Before you want to get kids to read, you need to get them to love stories and understand narrative and see why that's important, so they have a desire to learn to read. Whereas if you just get them decoding from day one, this is an A, this is a B, this is a C, put them all together and you can make words, then it's meaningless for them. It becomes a purely abstract operation and doesn't really fit with the stage of their development.
Sure. Okay. The next one is develop character.
So developing character, that's the sense that we've created an education system which focuses very narrowly on developing kids' cognitive abilities. And yet, of course, in every school, teachers and school leaders are striving daily to form their students as people, as successful people in the world. And this is really a call to say that we need to value the development of emotional intelligence, develop kids' well-being, and put these things at the same level as we do their cognitive development to help to contribute to overall the mental health of kids, the well-being of society. You look in the news every week, there are stories about the diminishment of kids' and adults' well-being these days. Now, I don't want us to create well-being classes in schools so that kids go out there into the world and suck up a miserable life working in a factory, but then in the evening they're able to sort of rationalize their experience and calm their emotions. But I think that we should use well-being as a way of building a healthier, weller society in which people know where to find their happiness and imagine new things that they might do. So it's really great. An old idea. This would have made perfect sense to the ancient Greeks. This was very much part of what they thought of an education was, or you know, Germans in the 18th century, their idea of Bildung rather than education. Education is not just about cognitive development, it's about developing the whole person.
Whole person, yeah. Great stuff. Okay. Well, that sort of ties into this next one as well, grow cooperation.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few interesting ideas, I think, to surface here. So, first of all, I think that our education systems are too often set up to pit kids against one another in this brutal race to the top. And that reinforces this individualistic idea, which I think has proven to be very unhealthy in our societies, certainly in the last, 30 or 40 years. And so the reason I think we should grow cooperation above all is primarily for the reason that I think it will help us to build societies which are more inclusive, more democratic, in which, and those societies, as people like, as that book, for example, the spirit level has shown, those are happier, better societies. They're also societies in which I think we get more done. We have this fantasy that of the individual genius going off and solving a problem or inventing something or launching a company, but it's always a team effort. So I think that we need to learn from our earliest stages that, yes, of course, it's important to develop our own individual abilities, but we're going to need to use them collectively. It's just as true for the modern workplace, if you want to use that argument, that we need to learn to work well in teams. All of the tech companies are always banging on about that stuff. They're looking for great cooperators and great learners these days.
Yeah. But it could be argued that competition has brought literacy to millions. I'm thinking of the Asian kids that are acing tests, but you suppose you wonder at what cost though.
It's so interesting. Yeah, I think that competition that you see in someone like Korea is brutal. So I met a couple of students and they showed me their revision timetable. So age 18, all South Koreans take this exam called the Sunyum, which happens on a single Thursday every year, and it's multiple choice, and afterwards you get ranked as a nation, so you know exactly where you are compared to all other kids in the country aged 18, and that decides your whole life, what university you'll go to, what job you're going to get. And it's driven this crazy bubble of insane hard work amongst those kids. So they showed me their revision timetables, and it's completely normal in the 3 years leading up to the Sunyum to work 14 hours a day, 5 days a week, and 12 hours a day on both Saturday and Sunday to prepare for it. And they've got this enormous burgeoning Hagwon industry worth tens of billions of dollars. And Hagwons are these private tutoring centres where kids go after school for several hours to learn how to take this Sunyum test and to do really well on it. And the country is gripped in this mental health crisis. It has the highest teen suicide rate in the world. I spoke to people who told me that during the Sunyum years, their hair had fallen out. People would look ashen-faced when they spoke about their education experiences. These are grown adults kind of looking back as though they'd returned from a war or something.
Okay, the next one is practice teaching.
Yeah, so I think it's easy to see teaching only as a knowledge profession. It's about how much a teacher knows, and then it's about helping kids also to know the same set of stuff. And of course, that's a big part of teaching. However, when you think about what teaching really is, and you think about this idea that in your classroom every day are 30, 60, 90, 120 different children, each with their own motivations, their own misunderstandings, their own identities and characters, and then what the learning process actually involves in their brains, in their psychology, in their motivation, in their ability to read and write and learn and have ideas about things, it becomes this incredibly complex profession. And I think that in the future, we need to think of teaching primarily as a profession, or if you like, as a craft. And I think that it's very much a practice. It's something that you do live every day in a real world scenario. Yes. It's not enough, like I thought it was when I started being a teacher, to get up in front of a class and talk about ideas. You need to understand what it is that's going to, first we need to understand what this child's abilities are in reading and writing, then what's going to motivate them to make the next step, but also what misconceptions they might have. And it's very practical. You also need to be able to understand how to capture the attention of a classroom of students, to inspire them to learn all the time. You wouldn't only train doctors by lecturing to them about different aspects of the profession. You get them to practice doing operations, to practice all of those little skills that make up their craft. And I think that teaching is absolutely the same. And that's going to be the big growth area, I think, for teaching in the future. And I think it could make it more attractive to people to think that it's this complicated, difficult craft that you're trying to master. We already get the amazing feeling that comes from working with kids, and the joy and the excitement that flows from that, and the feeling that you're doing really good work. I think if we added this extra element to it, then I think it could be, you know, among the most prestigious and respected professions.
And how important is it to connect, you know, in a sort of an embodied emotional way?
Yeah.
Is that necessary?
Yes. I think it's a really good question. People will tell you different things. So I think on the one hand, there's a school of thought which says that you don't need to connect. You can be a master craftsman who's able to manipulate kids' attention and behavior in such a way that you're able to get them learning, is able to set tasks, and it's much more of a technical understanding of what the role of the teacher might be. There's certainly a school of thought that would posit that in the UK. But my personal opinion is that relationships are fundamental to teaching. And that's because learning is fundamentally a social act. It's something that takes place between two people. And you see that in early years development. Kids, when they're very small, can't learn from the radio. They can't learn from a video. That's been proven. They can only learn from other human beings. And it's thought that our cognitive revolution that we underwent as human beings in order to become the learning, highly skilled, so-called, you know, supposedly intelligent people that we are today, came about because we developed this ability to essentially read the minds and intentions of other human beings in a way that other animals aren't capable of. Then it became possible for us then to have shared imagination about things, to pay shared attention to things, to develop ideas in common, to have ideas which could actually govern the thinking of a whole race of people. And it's that social bond which was crucial to the first act of learning between a parent and a child that I think remains crucial to the learning experience throughout our lives. We learn much better from humans. I've no doubt we learn much better from people that we feel some relationship with, whether it's professional or whether it's more personal, than we would from somebody who doesn't know us or understand us or get us. You know, you might then, you might as well then have a computer or a robot delivering content. What would be the point of a teacher if relationships didn't matter at all?
Okay. Well, just the last two points in the manifesto. Use technology wisely.
Yeah, this is the idea that we have to use technology wisely because there are lots of people creating pieces of technology that essentially want to put us to work in different ways. So whether that's Facebook trying to get you to spend as much time on it as possible so that it can sell your attention to an advertiser, or it's a tech company that's trying to sell iPads into schools so that you'll use their proprietorial software and they can gather lots of data about you, which will help them again to sell things to you in the future, or they're just trying to sell that tech to the schools. I think we need to be more circumspect than that. I don't think we should completely throw technology out, because it's clear that tech can do some exciting things. You know, we have access to this incredible world of information now. We can fast track some parts of thinking. We can, you know, go and visit countries on the other side of the world and grow our empathy. So there are these things that tech will be able to do. However, I think it needs to be teachers and parents and students themselves who are making the decisions about what use to put that tech to, what it can best be used for in developing kids, rather than the tech companies. And the tech companies' interest is not in developing you as a critical thinker, as a learner in the broadest sense of the word, who's able to create and to feel happy. Their interest is in engaging your intention. They want to give you the candy and the fizzy drinks of learning. They don't want to give you the difficult to digest meals, which are going to be good for you in the long run. And so that's why we need to learn to use tech wisely.
Okay, and the last one is build the future. You gave a great example of a biology teacher in Eton.
And so this is, by build the future, I mean that education has the power to affect what the future looks like and to really affect the future of the world. So we face these big challenges: automation of jobs, growing inequality worldwide, and climate change. And it feels like we're not doing that good a job of solving them. So I think we have to begin with our schools. And schools are the place where we create the minds of the future. We set the attitudes of future generations. And there was one amazing story that I heard in Eton College, where I spent a few days, and their biology teacher had come to the school. She's a very respected climate scientist and activist, and she had decided that the greatest influence that she could have on the future of climate change was to go and teach biology at Eton, because she was making the bet that it was pretty likely that the kids that passed through her classroom were going to go on to be politicians and business leaders and famous actors in the future. And if she could ensure that all of them were also climate activists who knew and believed in the climate change science and wanted to do something about it, then she really could change the world.
Fantastic. Yeah. Okay. We're just coming to the end here now. And it's a question you always ask people on these podcasts. What is your understanding of the middle way, and how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Yeah. I mean, I think my understanding of the middle way is that it's trying to create a place that rather than seeking to divide, whether you're dividing things into whatever, knowledge and skills is a common one in education, or feelings and knowledge or emotions or things, or different sides of a political debate, whether you're the left or right. The middle way, I feel like, is trying to create a space in the middle of those for a more moderate discussion in which both knowledge and feelings and different viewpoints are respected and valued, to basically chart a less extreme way through the world. And for me, that fits almost exactly with the aims of my book. So I believe in education that we've, at the moment, we're too far into the world of thinking that it's only content knowledge and a narrow set of skills that matter. We've see education as being all about competition. Education is a domain of certainty and of right answers, and it's about the economy and about getting a job. And I think that that is a partial, narrow view of what education is and could be. And in my book, I hope that I'm making an argument that says, yes, we need to take the lessons that we've learned about how our minds can best be developed, but we also need to bring an idea of creativity and using our hands and thinking anew to education. And we also need to bring back an element of well-being or emotion and of human solidarity to education. And to me, it feels that fits really well with the approach of the middle way society.
Okay, great. And my last question, if people wanted to find out more about your work, Alex, how would they go about it?
Yeah, I would love for people to get in touch with me. They could find me on Twitter at Alex F. Beard, or on my website, alexbeard.org. There's a button you can click to send me an email, and I welcome people to get in touch.
Fantastic. And I would, I couldn't recommend your book highly enough. It's been a great talking to you today, Alex, and a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yes, marvellous. That's great. Lovely to speak
Brilliant.
To you, Barry.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.